to DTF Radio. I am your host, McKinney McKinney, and you are now tuned in to The Truth Hurts. First, I would like to give thanks to God for allowing me to go through these trials that have polished my imperfections, illuminated my strengths in order to become resilient enough to be able to talk to you beautiful people this evening. Just to get further acquainted, I am a lifestyle blogger, event planner, women's empowerment organizer, showcase manager, advocate for mass incarceration awareness, entrepreneur, and last but certainly not least, I am the wife of wrongfully convicted Ricardo Marsden. You can find more of our story by following me on Instagram at McKinney101. That's M-A-K-I-N-I 101. This program is formulated to further bring awareness to mass incarceration while empowering the families of the incarcerated to provide resourceful information. Today, I will be sitting down with Khalil Kamabash from the New Yorkers of Justice. Khalil, welcome to Facing the Truth.
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
So, what exactly does your organization do? Let's start with that.
Yeah, sure. So, New Yorkers United for Justice is a organization that was founded to help pass law that would dramatically change the criminal justice system as we know it for the better. We got into this situation of mass incarceration by bad laws, by bad policy, and that's the only way that we'll actually get out of it. And so in New York State, as one of the most quote-unquote progressive states in the nation, depending who you ask, they will say it is the most progressive state in the nation, now is the time for us to hold our elected officials accountable to that rhetoric, for them to help pass law in New York State that would help to rectify many of the wrongs that are associated with the criminal justice system. And so at NYUJ, or New Yorkers United for Justice, it's our goal to pass these legislations. And so we work on state-level legislation, state-level policy, because we view that as the venue that will have the most impact in terms of law. New York City is only 5 of the 62 counties of New York State. There are 57 other counties that also have bad criminal justice laws and policies on the books. And so we view working on a state level as a way to change New York State, not only New York City.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. If we're not starting with the laws that were placed there to begin with that are not in favor of us, brown people.
Mm-hmm.
So what legislative actions has this organization taken to change this deeply flawed justice system?
The legislative session in New York State generally runs from January 1 to mid-June. This year, it started January 2nd and ended June 19th.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this time frame is when our elected officials, our state elected officials, folks in the Senate and folks in the Assembly, this is the time in which they pass law that impacts New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that time frame, advocates are frantically trying to do everything that they can, educate the new elected officials, work with the governor's office, work with local officials to help educate them on what these policies would mean if passed. And so everyone is working frantically to try to get something passed. Now, keep in mind that criminal justice reform, although it is something that folks like you and I live and breathe and it's what we think about daily, for elected officials, it's one of many big things that they have to do in that time frame. And so this last legislative session, NYUJ, what we took on was to help to bring the conversation around bail reform, speedy trial reform, and discovery reform to a close. We wanted to help push that effort to the finish line. And so that's one of the fights that we took on. We launched a massive video campaign and invested $500,000 in running ads all across the state to help educate constituents and elected officials on what these three reforms would mean. thankfully, in conjunction with many other advocates who had worked on this issue decades, in some cases before we came on the scene, we were able to get that passed on March 31st with the New York State budget. Simultaneously, we were also working to get some level of expungement on the record in New York State. And now, so, you know, I think most folks would think of someone making a mistake, and if that mistake was 20, 30, 40 years ago, which in many cases it is for many people involved in the criminal justice system, that they somehow should have that taken off of their record. You know, I know that folks advocate for that in New York State, and then there's folks that advocate against that, right? Someone wants the ability to know if you committed a robbery 50 years ago. They still want to know that 50 years.
Right.
But if we are truly going to believe in redemption, then we have to give people a true, indeed, access to a second chance, and
Absolutely.
That includes expunging criminal records. And expungement means that a person would no longer have to admit that they were convicted of a felony conviction. And so we were working with many other advocates to try to get some level of expungement involved in the marijuana legalization conversation. Marijuana legalization, although it didn't pass this session, it is very likely that it will pass next session.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that we wanted was that if you're going to now say that a drug that was deemed illegal, it is now legal, then we have to retroactively remove all of those convictions that are associated with the same drug that you now say is legal.
Absolutely.
And so
Absolutely.
Those two fights were, I'm happy to say, were to some extent successful, and we were able to get some progress on it. In conjunction with that, we recently, actually yesterday, we launched a massive clemency campaign to push Governor Cuomo to use his executive power in clemency. We want him to use it more. To date, he has used it not as much as many advocates would like, but he has used it in the past to free people of immigration consequences, to free people from sentences that in some cases were too extensive, that didn't fit the charge and the crime,
mm-hmm.
And then to free people who had shown levels of rehabilitation way before their minimum release date. And so we want him to exercise that power more. We are happy to say that we launched a campaign that's going to be five videos. They're going to be released over the next 3 or 4 weeks. And we are investing a six-figure amount to back that campaign and to run those videos all over digital and social media.
I think that's going to be extremely effective.
Well, we hope so. I mean, you know, NYUJ, you know, in terms of criminal justice reform in New York, you know, you choose an organization, and you know, there's an organization for every single issue. And so, with NYUJ just recently launched in January of this year, you know, us being the quote-unquote new kid on the block, we are trying to find creative ways to leverage the resources that we have, particularly financial resources that we have, to add to the efforts that have already been done by other organizations who were here before us. And so we're always trying to find creative ways, and the clemency campaign is one of those ways. We're not the first organization to talk about the governor's need to use clemency, but we are the first organization that is able to invest resources in a way that brings that conversation to a level that it just hasn't been.
I think that's amazing. Friend's on the phone.
Oh, nice.
I'm gonna log him in.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. Hold on. I'm looking around. We'll have this conversation. Oh, my goodness. I can't believe it. Looks like that's not going to happen.
It needs the Apple thing.
Yeah, this is the Apple one. Okay. Actually, we're not going to be able to. You're on speaker. Hello?
Okay.
I'm with Khalil right now.
hallways in which I, you know, I grew up in, quite honestly. And where a lot of my honing and sharpening as an individual was done. And so I was really, really grateful to be there for an entire day. We were down in J School. Good surprise.
Yeah.
You know what it is? Like, every time that you speak to someone who's incarcerated, their outlook on life is generally so pure,
yeah.
Right? And because, you know, like, the everyday rigmarole of life, you know, you just, quite honestly, you start to forget and you take for granted of the fact that, you know, blank years ago or blank months ago or blank weeks ago, you were in a prison. And when you speak to someone who is in that condition,
mm-hmm.
and he says nothing but positive things, right? Like, yo, I'm just waiting for my moment.
Yeah.
I'm around these elders. Like, you, if you spoke to him and you didn't tell someone where he was physically located, you wouldn't know, right? You'd be like, damn, this dude is the most optimistic person I've talked to in a long time, right? And, like, from my experience, that happens a lot with people who are incarcerated, but particularly people who are incarcerated in maximum security prisons. Because, you know, when you're in a maximum, at least in my experience, you know, you're around life and death situations all the time. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, maybe you're not physically in harm, but the reality of you looking at a 70-plus-year-old individual, 80-plus-year-old individual, and know that that person's going to die in prison, you're literally around death.
Right.
And there are people who have become complacent and comfortable with that because they have to. That's their reality. And
right.
When you're around that and you know that, as, you know, maybe I'm looking at a 25 to life, and as uphill of a battle as that looks, when you're around that other option, your outlook on life is much more positive, right? And so I've always found that every time you speak to someone who's incarcerated, they always have this level of positivity that is very different than what you hear, what you encounter when you're out here in the street.
That is very true. He uplifts me more, I feel, than I uplift him.
I believe.
Dealing with this kind of situation and doing it by yourself, you kind of feel alone and like the whole world is on you because you have so many things that you have to manage as a family member. You have to manage your own household. You got to manage his living and everything else around it.
Yeah.
So,
and you have to manage being a woman, a black
yeah,
woman,
yeah.
a strong black woman,
yeah.
right? Like all of that comes with, you know, the reality of what people perceive that to be, right? And like, I was just listening to, on the way here, we were listening to the new Lion King album that came out, executive produced by Beyonce, and on there is a song called Brown Skin Girl, and you know, like, it talks about the realities of just, like, living in that body. You know what I mean? Like, all of the struggles that come with that.
Yeah.
And the reality is that, you know, not only on top of all of those, you know, circumstances that you just mentioned, focus on, you know, the fact that for every one of those cases, there are dozens, you know, if not hundreds of more cases where people are actually successful in maintaining a relationship before, during, and after prison. And so, you know, it's unfortunate. I think that the missing piece that all too often leads to unsuccessful relationships post-incarceration are generally pieces that relate to the individual's pain, frustration, experiences, trauma stemming from incarceration. All too often, that's not always the case. I'm not speaking in absolute terms, but from my experiences, I think that all too often, you know, stems back to some type of experience that comes from incarceration. Just another negative effect that the system has on individuals of color, but also on relationships.
And the children. Because they don't understand what's going on at the time. The fact that there's a separation within that family, they can feel it. They can't necessarily put it into words, but they can actually feel that something is off balance. But, you know, speaking on that topic, what are some things that you've learned about society and the system that directly affect your time?
Can we curse?
You can say whatever you want to say here.
I mean, just that, you know, the system, first of all, there's a level of harmful intention. Like, it is very intent on being harmful. It is not a system that is, you know, somehow awry or somehow, as Michelle Alexander would say, has fallen off of the tracks. It is very intent is to cause destruction in an individual's life in every single aspect of it, including family, including with children, including with society. And so that's one of the major awakenings that I've had, is that we are talking about a system that is working exactly how it was designed to work.
Yep.
And the moment that we start to understand that, then we start to adjust our strategy, our tactics, our approach to help change that system, not to help fix that system, because the reality is that, as many advocates have said and will say, the system is not broken.
Exactly, and so it works.
And so that's one of the major epiphanies that I've had since my involvement in the criminal justice system, is that the system is just designed on breaking an individual and every single aspect of that person's life very intently. The second realization that I've had is that our families, particularly our women, as history has shown us, history leading all the way back to the continent of Africa, that women are all too often the ones who bear the most brunt of the damage that's caused by mass incarceration, by the criminal justice system. If you look now, you know, all of the movements that are, you know, that we can call movements right now, are all too often led, held up, pushed forward, funded by, kept breathing by women, and particularly women of color. I think of, you know, Eric Garner, rest in peace, and his situation, his brutal murder on tape, and the ones that you see all too often speaking up for him are women of color, right?
Yeah.
His mother, his daughter, you know, rest her soul as well. His other daughter, and that's just a reflection of what this system, you know, like who's the ones that are actually, you know, the ones that are the who bear the brunt of its injustice. And so that's the second epiphany that I've had, is that you know, the most disrespected person in this country, as Malcolm X said, is the black woman, and the most unprotected and the most vilified is the black woman. And then the third reality, the third kind of awakening and epiphany that I've had, especially post-incarceration, is that as insurmountable as it may seem, that one day we will dramatically change the system as we know it. One day the criminal justice system as it exists in this country will no longer be the way that it is. And as hard as that is to actually imagine and will happen. And if we look at other movements, other social justice movements, although, you know, we could look at many of the ways that it fell short of what the true vision was for change, the systems that came after that were not like the ones that were prior to that movement happening. And then in conjunction with that, we have to be diligent and not be rocked to sleep, that whatever comes after mass incarceration, that we don't allow it to backslide into mass incarceration. The access to voting rights are a clear example of that. You know, the Civil Rights Act allowed, you know, extended voting rights to a certain population, and over the last 40 or 50 years, that has slowly been reeled back by court case after court case to the point where it's almost back to where it was 40 or 50 years ago. So we have to be diligent to make sure that that doesn't happen with mass incarceration.
Absolutely.
Someone says no volume. I don't know what that means.
I guess they can. Can you guys hear?
NYUJ's goal is to, you know, again, pass legislation that we believe will help to dramatically change the criminal justice system or aspects of the criminal justice system as we know it. I think that collectively, as one organization that is lending to the movement of criminal justice reform, the movement to end mass incarceration, as those organizations are part of a larger movement, I think that the one thing that needs to happen to dramatically reach that goal is to dramatically change as a society. And when I say as a society, not just New York City, not just New York State, not just the Eastern Seaboard, not just the flyover states, like as a society.
Yeah.
We have to change the perception that comes with, or the negative perception that comes with, who it is that we're talking about. And so, for example, as you know, even in some places of this city, again, the quote-unquote most aggressive city in the world, depending on who you ask,
right.
When you say things like criminal justice reform, people say, yes, except if you did blank, blank, and blank. And generally, the examples that they all too often jump to are the most heinous offenses that a person can commit towards another person. Murder, rape, you know, physical assault, so on and so forth. And while those concerns undoubtedly are valid, all too often we are looking at the symptoms of a much deeper problem. And there's a ton of research and data that shows that once you provide access to opportunities equitably, not equally, equitably, and opportunities means stable employment, good medical, a stable housing. Once you provide these basic things, you know, Maslow would say that these are the basic human, the hierarchy of human needs. If once you provide those basic things, levels of violence dramatically drop. Spousal disagreements dramatically drop. Rates of divorce, rates of high blood pressure, teenage pregnancy, STD, all of that dramatically drops if you just give folks access to opportunity.
Yeah.
And so we need to dramatically change the perception of who we're talking about, but also at the same time, we need to increase access, equitable access to opportunities that will help to stabilize individuals and then therefore prevent. And so the bigger conversation to have is that when we talk about criminal justice reform, it is bigger than the criminal justice system. So we're talking about housing, employment,
right.
health. health care, women's rights, women's health care. We're talking about all of it. And that is the one thing that we need to start doing as advocates, is not just look at or talk about the criminal justice system or keep our lens on the criminal justice system and say, if we fix that today, if we ended mass incarceration, if we right now released everyone that is in a jail cell or prison cell or immigration detention center, juvenile justice center, and we released everybody today, the policies, the laws, in the next 4 or 5 months, we're going to have another 2.3 million people,
yeah.
Right? Because we haven't gotten to the core of what the problem is.
Rehabilitate society as a
mm-hmm.
whole,
because
it's not just the people that are incarcerated. So it's everything. So I definitely agree with that. Let's see. From your own experience, what has been your biggest necessity reintegrated back into society?
I think first let me say that, you know, that there are many different modalities of thinking as it relates to, you know, what is the one piece that could help to stabilize someone the fastest. And some people have an ideology that, you know, housing is the most important. Some people say education is the most important. Some people say employment is the most important. And undoubtedly, like, all of those pieces are important. And the reality is that we're not talking about a cookie cutter answer for every single person that's returning from, you know, from jail and or prison. But all of those pieces are undoubtedly important. I think from my experience and from my perspective and my analysis of the reentry process, there is one major thing that is a much longer fight, is a much longer goal to achieve. The major thing that needs to happen is, again, the dramatic shift of who it is that we're talking, the shift of perception. And so, for example, 40 or 50 years ago, in this city, if a person identified openly as being LGBTQ, they were ostracized from everything, housing, employment, you know, you name it, even familial ties in some cases. Now, that is like almost unheard of.
Yeah.
And there are a ton of backlash that a person would get if it was found out that they actually did ostracize someone simply because they identified as LGBTQ. And that is because of the huge shift in perception that has happened, attributed largely to the efforts of advocates and directly impacted people. Similarly, 30 years ago in this city, if a person identified as HIV positive, they could also be ostracized because of all of those, you know, because of all the negative perceptions.
Yeah.
Now it is almost unheard of for that to happen.
That's
and if it
true.
Does happen, there is a huge backlash that a person can get, not only from, you know, from society at large, but also legally. Right? Like we've implemented protection for people who identify as both of those parties. That is what we need for the criminal justice system, so that when someone comes home and someone says, yes, I served 30 years of incarceration because I unfortunately at a very young age in a very stupid decision, in a very harmful decision or series of decisions, I took someone's life. Or yes, I was overly punished because of a small level of drugs, and under federal statute was given this much time as a mandatory minimum. Or that I was a young kid and I served 15 years, and although I'm 32, you do the math, I'm a much different person now. Then, once we change that perception, it'll be easy for folks to get housing, to get employment. Because right now, people are judging us, people with felony convictions, based on a lot of that misperception and a lot of that false perception.
That is so true. That is so true. And anyone affiliated with anyone who is incarcerated, you get the same treatment.
Yeah.
You get ostracized the same.
Yeah, because people don't understand. You know, people don't understand the system. Or people say, so did you really do it? And so, yeah, there is a huge, huge misperception of the realities of the criminal justice system. And all too often, when a person's perception shifts, is when they themselves get exposed to how vicious and destructive the system can be once you get ensnared in it.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, look, we're learning a lot now, right, about the true injustices of the system in many different aspects from the Netflix documentary When They See Us. Like, people are enraged about that. Now, mind you, that happened in the 80s.
And it's still going on.
And it is still going on. It is legal in New York. It is legal across the country for law enforcement officials, while interrogating you, to use deception. It is perfectly legal for them to lie to you to get you to confess to something that you may or may not have done. And so people are enraged by that. But don't forget, like, you know, they have been fighting that case to change their perception for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
In 2002 is when the conviction got overturned.
Yeah.
And you know, thank God for Ava DuVernay and the level of attention that her name alone brought to this. People are outraged now. And those brothers undoubtedly deserve all the love and attention that they're getting, but they weren't getting that before When They See Us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And like, so like, once our perception shifted of who we were talking about, all the love came. Right? And that is exactly what we need, not only for people who are innocent of the crimes that they've been charged and convicted of, but people who are also guilty.
Yeah.
Because there's a bunch of people in the system who are guilty, will admit their guilt, readily admit their guilt, have done a bunch of work to redeem themselves, to rehabilitate themselves, to change themselves, and when they come home, don't come home to that same level of fanfare. Or at least some portion of that, or at least an opportunity to show society who, what they have done, all the work that they put in to change who they
are. Which is kind of like a slap in the face.
Oh, yeah, it's a complete slap in the face. I mean, imagine if you worked 25, 30 years towards something, and the moment that you're given your opportunity, the moment that you're like, now it is showtime, I'm ready to show the world, they say, nah, I don't care about that, man. Yeah, nah, all that's cute and all that, but like, nah, you still murder somebody. It's like, you know what, like, who wants to be held accountable consistently for the rest of their life for one or two decisions that they've made? Like, no one would want that, right? Like, no one would want to continuously answer for that moment in their life, especially when there's a huge level of shame associated with that.
Absolutely. I think that everybody needs to heal. We have to learn how to accept people in the situations that they've been through. We need to move forward as a community, especially within our... I think the most healing that needs to be done is with minorities. There's a lot of lack of support within our own community, in our own
race.
And I don't feel like we're able to move forward with anything until we acknowledge that and learn how to embrace each other despite all the things that have been going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Willie Lynch syndrome in its living embodiment, right? Like, the idea of exploiting the differences, no matter how small they are, to cause division and to sow disunity amongst the ranks, right? And so, light skin versus dark skin, you know, blue eyes versus brown eyes, tall versus short, and even here in the city, Bronx versus Queens, Queens versus Brooklyn, right? And then even that, Flatbush versus, like there are ways that we have been fooled and to use another Malcolm X word, bamboozled, to believe that these differences are actually worth something, like that they're actually worth anything at all, but more importantly, that they're worth taking someone's life for,
right?
And so even amongst us, when we say, you know, change the criminal justice system, people again are saying, wait, but what are you gonna do with all the bad people? And you're like, oh, the bad people like your son? Because they'll lock his ass up too in a minute.
Right.
The bad people like your sister, because she's locked up for something that she didn't do at all, right? And so once they get ensnared in the system is when they start to realize, yo, the system is not what it seems, right? I don't know how many people because they just couldn't manage that problem anymore. And the one thing that they thought would help, because they had a misperception of the system,
right,
is to call the police or to put you in the system. And that's, you know, and that's because of a huge misunderstanding of what the criminal justice system actually does to an individual once they're ensnared. But that happens even amongst, even in our community.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know how many times we just be hanging out. I grew up in Southside Jamaica, Queens, which is not too different from Brownsville or East New York. We be hanging out, not really doing anything from our perspective. You know, doing what these folks are doing right now, just hanging out, chilling.
Right.
Nobody's being, you
enjoying
know,
life.
Enjoying life. But we were young, right? And, like, we were known to do stupid things. But at that moment, we weren't doing anything stupid, anything illegal, anything dangerous. And then we'd have the cops called on us. And the police would come undercover. They'd run up on us like, yo, oh, you know, we got a call. And so one of y'all had a gun. But all they really wanted was for us to leave the block, was to not make noise late at night on a weekday, on a weekday when people got to go to work in the morning.
Yeah.
And, like, but there was such a disconnect between us and the, and our community neighbors, like our neighbors, our elders, that they couldn't come to us and say, yo, it's late, y'all, come on. You know what I'm saying? Like, because
that's
they were fearful,
yes,
of what the outcome would be. And so the next best resolution was to do what? Call the cops. Right?
Yes.
Hoping that, you know, with the understanding, the only thing I want them to do is leave, but the next thing you know, somebody's getting locked up. Somebody's getting shot.
Right.
Somebody's getting beat up. Somebody's getting harassed. When if there was a better connect there, or, you know, like we could have easily just left the block upon a request. But that's not to say, like, that can happen. Like, the reality is there is a huge disconnect between
and lack of communication. Had people known how to effectively communicate with each other, a lot of these things wouldn't even happen.
Yeah.
Especially with the elders.
Yeah.
And that is the big, there's a big gap between the two, and there really shouldn't be, because
oh, for sure,
we should be able to look up to the elders for wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be able to look at us and say, you know, different things. They should be able to help and embrace us. But people don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Once you have any sort of label, they just write you off, toss you to the side.
Yeah.
And they beat you down the rest, the same way the rest of society does.
Yeah.
But then they expect you to progress.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
can anybody progress in a negative environment?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, here... Like, here's the deeper thing. I mean, even, you know, again, speaking to the Willie Lynch syndrome, the most dangerous part of all of that is at some point the individual starts to believe that.
Yeah.
So the individual starts to believe that, yo, me, you know, like, you know,
mm-hmm.
me and this guy right here don't have nothing in common. As a matter of fact, he looked like he's trying to be my father, and I got issues with my father already, right?
Yeah.
And, like, he looked like he's trying to, she sound like she's trying to be like my mom's, and she's not my mother, right? Like we start to believe that. And I remember when I was much younger, like, you know, somebody that was older than me couldn't really tell me anything, right? And it's because I was so ignorant and I was so self-centered and I was so, I had bought so much into this false persona of who I was supposed to be as a young man of color that I thought that it was the right thing to be disrespectful to my elders. And it wasn't until I was in the prison system when I learned the value of listening to elders, the value of listening to that wisdom.
Yeah.
But I was already in the belly of the beast, and I would argue and say that all too often, that's exactly what happens. By the time we are awakened to what the evils that are against us in society, it's already too late.
Yeah.
That realistically, you know, on a policy level, I would love to see New York State in the next 4 years. You know, first of all, let's think about what the country would be like in the next 4 years. You know, it is with all likelihood, if we do not take this very serious, that we could have another 4 years of the current president that we have. Like, that is a very clear reality. It is also a reality that we could, as a state, you know, as New York State, we can continue to have what they call a triple blue state, where the two houses of the legislative body are Democrat, and that the governor is Democrat. doesn't mean that they're going to be as progressive as we want them to be, but it does mean that we could have a triple blue state in amongst the chaos that exists right now, and potentially the chaos that exists in a second term, right? And so 4 years from now, we're looking at, you know, this if this president wins re-election, coming down to the end of his second term. And we don't know what the country's going to look like, you know, in the next 4 years. But as a triple blue state, I would like to see the state work to decrease the population, the prison population, more subsequently, to the point where they can close one or two more prisons. I would like to see them close one or two maximum security prisons. I would like to see that the reform efforts that New York United for Justice has put forth, in conjunction with many of our sister and brother organizations, that we like to see that implementation actually take effect in a positive way and to help relieve some of the injustices that happen in the criminal justice system. And so that's like practically, but like big picture thinking, I would like to see that we have, as a country, begin to come a little bit closer to the reality of grappling with some of the most deeply rooted ills of this country, and that has to do with not only systemic racism, that has to do with this country's history, that has to do with the way that we celebrate things in this country, you know, Columbus Day and others, and how that really doesn't really have a positive impact on communities of color. I would like to see that we, at some point in the next 4 years, can have someone who is openly, formally incarcerated, be in elected office, whether that's a city job, whether that's a city position, a state position, or a federal position, and not have that have any real weight on this person's ability to do the job that they were elected to do. In the next 4 years, I would love to see that, you know, that we don't have to use the term mass incarceration, that we have somehow moved the needle far enough and brought the numbers down far enough that we don't have to refer to it as the epidemic that it is now. In the next 4 years, I would like to see that there is more unity, quite honestly, amongst people of color, and amongst the advocacy community that fights for criminal justice reform, amongst the organizations and the advocates that fight for different issues. So I would love to see immigrant rights folks working better with criminal justice folks working better with survivors of sex trafficking. I would like to see just a better cohesion of efforts to help address the ills that all too often different heads of the same body. And then lastly, I would like to see that we, you know, again, big picture, have begun to grapple with some of the long-term impacts of mass incarceration. You know, we're talking about a system in its current form that was enacted in the middle of the 90s. In another 4 years, we're looking at, you know, almost 20 plus years of this system ravishing, and we need to begin to grapple with what that is going to mean in the next 20 years.
Right,
like to some extent, we're still grappling with the ramifications of chattel slavery in this country. And don't think that if we ended mass incarceration tomorrow, that those issues are going to go away.
Right.
There's going to be long-term issues that we have to begin to talk about now. And I would hope that in the next 4 years, we can do that.
I agree 100%. So how do you think that community can help? Where do they start? Because I guess the first step is accepting what is actually going on, what they're in, and how everybody's actually affected.
Yeah.
So from that point, how do they actually fix? How do they heal?
Yeah.
Where do they start?
Yeah. Well, two things.
How do we help them?
Yeah. One of the things, you know, the analogy of leading a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Yeah.
An analogy that I use in conjunction with that is that if you lead a horse to water and it refuses to drink, the bare minimum is that it acknowledges that it is water. We are talking about all too often the scenario of leading a horse to water to drink, and they say, "What water?" Like, they don't understand the severity or the reality of what is in front of us. And so I really do believe that there are people that don't give enough credit to the mass incarceration disaster and emergency and epidemic that is happening right now in this country. I don't believe that when people see children in cages that it hits them hard enough. I don't believe that when people see a man who is clearly being nonviolent choke to death and yell the best that he can that I cannot breathe, I don't think that people give that the weight that it needs. And it's because, and the reason I say that is because when you ask people about things like mass incarceration, you know, they say, you know, but if a person can't do the time, then they shouldn't do the crime. And or they say, you know, well, you know, just don't choose to do crime and like you wouldn't be exposed to that system. And we know from our personal experiences that all too often you could be on the walking the most straightest line possible, but because of the color of your skin, because of the clothes that you wear, because of the way that you talk, you could be stopped and harassed and dragged into the criminal justice system. And so I think that that is a major problem. And one of the things that community members could do, if you do want to learn about how devious this system can be, is go sit in arraignment court. Criminal courts are open to the public. Most of us only end up in there, or we end up going there because we're in it or because a family member. But you can go in there. It's open to the public. And sit in arraignment court and see the process as it unfolds in front of you. Because I guarantee you most people would not be able to accurately describe the realities of the criminal justice system. What they say is, well, everyone has their day in court, right? Like, no, that's not really how it works. Or, you know, if a person is innocent, then they wouldn't hold them. That's not how it
exactly.
really works.
Exactly.
And every now and then we get exposed. There's a story that comes out that exposes us to the realities of the system. Khalif Browder is one. There's many other examples. But in the most recent history, Khalif Browder, most recently, in the most recent past, is when they see us. When they see us peel back layers of the criminal justice system that shows you what they will do to young children of color if allowed to. And don't be fooled. Although that happened in the 80s and the city was a much different city in the 80s, it still happens today.
Of course, yeah.
And so every now and then we get these stories that expose the truth. But even after that frustration and anger goes away, people tend to, you know, once the anger subsides, people's attention also moves. And to everyone's credit, including mine, you know, we're dealing with so many issues at the same time that all too often you become overwhelmed. And I know that I also go through moments where I don't want to watch the news. I don't want to watch TV. I don't want to watch a timeline, because it seems like everything that just comes out is bad after bad after bad, and inhumane after inhumane after inhumane. But you know, it's in those moments that we have to take time to self care, and then we have to step back up to the plate. If you want to see what the system is like, community members, go to arraignment court. That'll give you a real exposure. And if you want to do something after that, look at how you can use your voice via the vote to impact local policy, state policy, federal policy. And
that
voting for the president is undoubtedly important, but it is not the only election that actually dramatically changes the state of a country.
So please go out and the truth.
Is it time already?
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me.
No problem. And just let everybody know where they can find
strikes and send a letter to the governor asking him to use his clemency power more. You can follow us on social media at NY4FOR Justice. You can follow me on social media